Chapter 13. The Snow That Never Melted.
"It stretches through here," Yeoman Goodis grunted around the pipe stem clenched in his teeth, as he used his broad shoulders and long arms to indicate the front wall of his manor house. "This end of the wall is pure white. By the time it ends on the corner, you can only see flecks. It was a wonder," the Bovali-born yeoman said, shaking his head. "It was indeed," I said, surveying the wall. It was the best example I'd seen yet of the fading edge of the magical effect that had turned my castle, and apparently almost everything else in a 2-mile radius, brilliant, unblemished white. Whatever had happened 2 weeks before, it had extended to the middle of Southridge Hold, and had affected all the stone and clay in 3/4 of his long home. "Notice anything else strange about it?"
"Nay," he said. "Close your eyes and put a hand on it. You can't tell it from regular stone. It's just white."
"You did it, Mage Lord, or one of your apprentices?"
"Actually, we're still looking into it," I said, cautiously but confidently. I didn't want to let him know too much. I didn't know enough myself to tell him anything more definitive than "it's white." "We'll know more when the weather clears and I can order some special equipment. But it wasn't done on purpose, I promise you. About the best I can tell you is that it happened precisely at the moment my son was born." The farmer looked spooked.
"You don't say. Imagine that. A sign from the gods, perhaps?"
"That's a better explanation than most," I conceded, "and I can't rule it out." I felt a little guilty every time someone mentioned the effect as a sign from the gods, since I had actually appealed to the fire goddess Brigga that fateful night in a fit of desperation. I couldn't rule out divine intervention, but that was a damn hard thing to quantify, or even identify.
"Yeah, I think it's a sign from the gods. A good one," he added hastily.
"It's white, after all."
"More likely it's some natural, magical phenomenon," I said, trying to steer clear of theurgy. "But we'll keep looking into it. Apart from that, how did you and yours fare the storm?"
"Ah, we were fine, Mage Lord, snug as pigs in slop. Enough to eat, if not fancy, plenty of wood, and dry as a bone, now that the roof is repaired. Apart from the sudden and mysterious magical transformation of my entire new holding, it was relatively quiet."
We both chuckled at that. "Well, keep an eye on it, and report any strangeness to Sir Kay."
"Strangeness, Mage Lord?"
he asked, curious.
"What kind of strangeness?"
"People suddenly bursting into flames, cows flying across the pasturelands under their own power, the sudden appearance of giant bees, you know, strangeness."
"Is any of that likely to happen, Mage Lord?"
"Really?" he asked skeptically. I shrugged.
"It's only been around 1.5 weeks, and most of that time it was under snow. But every bit of dirt and soil and rock and stone is like this now. The entire mountain and cliffs, too. I figured the effect was temporary, but it hasn't faded at all. The truth is, I really have no idea. But if you see anything like that, let us know. So far, nothing strange has happened at the castle, and we're surrounded by it. I'm guessing if there are going to be any odd effects, they'll likely happen either at the core, when it started, or out here where it ended. So, keep us informed."
"Oh, I will, Mage Lord," he assured me, wide-eyed. "So, how are you finding life as a yeoman?" I asked, smiling, as we walked back through the muddy slush. There was still a foot of snow on the ground, but it was starting to melt. Goodis' men had carved trenches through the snow between the main manor hall and the outbuildings, but the rest of the land was still buried.
"It's a pleasure, and a far better life than we ever expected, Mage Lord," he said humbly. "And I don't mind saying I have you and the gods to thank. Back in Beauval Castle during the siege, I figured that was the end of me and mine. The great goblin soup pot. Then all those months at that castle, eating cast-off temple offerings and whatever the folk could manage to scrape up, I thought we'd be turned out on the road by now. Bandits, or worse. And now, not a year later, and we're living like lordly folk in this fine house. It's a blessing from the gods, it is," he said, starting to tear up. "And you, of course, Lord Menelan."
It's the least I could do for an old neighbour, I dismissed, looking away uncomfortably, unwilling to embarrass the man. Besides, I think I borrowed your shears back in Minden's Hall before the invasion and neglected to return them before I left, so we can call it even. So how are you situated for spring planting? Goodis looked thoughtful, puffing away at his pipe. There's a sufficiency of seed, mostly maize and oats with a little barley, he admitted. Enough for 20, maybe 25 acres. The stock is decent, and I think we'll have enough hay. But if the snow doesn't clear in the east pasture soon, I'll have bony beasts or fewer beasts when the fodder runs out. He sounded grim, but accepting of the possibility, as any farmer was. Storehouse isn't too bad either. Looks like old Ilveen kept back more than he let on. Found 5 hams in a compartment under the corn crib. 5! And the natives are getting on with your folk? I asked. That was the big question, and the main reason I wanted to come out here. The white stone was just a convenient excuse. Southridge had 10 families and a bunkhouse full of farmhands, over 150 people. 12 of them were Bovali. I could handle finding more feed or more beasts for Southridge, but if the natives rebelled at the thought of a foreign yeoman... Oh, they've been fine, Mage Lord, he assured me. A little put off at first, but they loosened up a bit once the beer came out. We've got to know each other, thanks to the storm. They're a little rough, and there have been some disagreements, but I think we'll do fine. Most are good folk, just scared. As long as no one goes hungry, we'll be in good shape when the thaw comes. If we can keep the stock alive, that is, he added, troubled. I was hoping to have the sheep on the east pasture by today, if there was enough cleared, but there's still 1/2 a foot of snow on it. Not much we can do about that. I suppose it will be mutton for a few nights, he finished with some consolation. I knew that was trouble. Southridge was poorly suited for growing most grain crops, apart from some oats and maize, but what it lacked in hearty topsoil, it made up for in pasturage. It was once the site of a horse breeding operation, if the castle records were to be believed. In more recent years, it had been the holding that had supplied most of the Vale's wool. Southridge had a small flock, but Goodis was hopeful that he could grow it. Having to slaughter stock before lambing to keep the rest fed was a big step backward in getting the place viable. But I couldn't conjure up hay the way I could light, or run time forward enough to expose the pasture. Or could I? A thought struck me. Actually, maybe there is. Where is this pasture? I hadn't tried any serious magic since the baby was born. I was too busy holding Minalion and being a smitten daddy. I was also still recovering from the big, nameless spell that I'd cast that night. It hadn't been without effect on me, and for a few days my sphere was touchy if I tried to use it for anything serious. That had mostly passed now, but there were still some lingering effects of the exertion. Today I felt particularly thoughtful about it, not just because of the white stone. It was Brigger's Day, the feast day of the goddess of fire, baking, magic, poetry, midwifery, etc., who I had invoked during the working. I felt obligated to get out of the old castle and see how Sevendor had held up, because part of Brigger's mythology involved all sorts of unlikely run-ins with other deities, in which the goddess usually demonstrated compassion for the weak and vulnerable. In some ways, this was my ritual to the Bright One, to thank her for sparing both my son and my wife. The weather warmed on Brigger's Day. Traditionally, it was when the ewes are milked for the first time, and all sorts of folklore surrounds observations made on this day concerning weather and crops. Maybe I could show my gratitude to the fire goddess by helping graze her sacred animal. We had been lucky. It was a major storm that had closed roads and passes for weeks across the wilderlands, and we had no fatalities. We learned that 6 people had died of cold just over the frontier with Westphalia, in the depressing district just to our north. We had 5 times their population, and not one death. I was proud of that. But if we couldn't keep our people fed, we'd be in trouble. I surveyed the wide expanse of snow where Goodis had led me. It was peppered with the tracks of birds and animals and children, but you couldn't see a single blade of grass underneath. Goodis watched with interest as I took out my oversized witchstone and began the spell. I won't go into technical details, but I heated up a mass of air in a disc 300 feet in diameter, heated it up by 10 degrees. The snow started to melt at once. It's usually hard, heating up a stationary air mass in breezy outdoor conditions, so I increased the heat to quicken the process. I figured it would take 10 minutes or so to melt it, but oddly enough the spell only took a quarter of the time. Mere moments later, a soggy, muddy field of brown grass and green shoots had replaced the field of snow. "That should help," I said simply, putting my stone away. I was tired from the exertion, but it was a good kind of tired. The spell had hooked into place and worked as easily as a dream. This was the kind of work I'd wanted to do as a spellmonger in the first place. Good, helpful magic.
"God's truth, my lord," Goodis said, delighted. "It will indeed. Can't you do that for the whole valley?"
I pointed to the bottom of the pasture where it encountered a low hedge. The lowest corner was already filling with pooled snowmelt. "That's going to flood, and it won't be the only place. If I did much more than this, then the stream would flood out. And right now I have almost 1,000 people camped on the floodplain of the commons."
"Oh, right you are, Lord Minolin," he agreed sagely after I'd pointed it out. "Still, every acre cleared by magic is one less we have to wait on. We get these beasts grazing for a few days, we can stretch out our hay supply."
"That's a good point," I agreed reluctantly. "But that causes more problems downstream. That's the problem with magic sometimes. You can't do just one thing."
"Aye, there's wisdom in that, Mage Lord," Goodis said solemnly.
"Come inside for a drink, Mage Lord," he asked, "to toast your young'un." I sighed. My toes were cold, standing in that pasture. It was warming, but that didn't mean it was warm. The idea of a nip of something sounded lovely.
"That would be much appreciated," I agreed.
He led me back inside and called for someone to bring him his jug. Goodis' oldest lad proudly brought his father an elegantly simple earthenware jug.
"Got it from, well, your brother-in-law," he said, a trifle guiltily. "Apparently Ferent left behind a few gallons of his best, tucked away in the root cellar. He sent me one for Yule, and it's never been more welcome."
He poured 2 glasses of the dark brown liquor.
"Takes a bit of getting used to the taste."
I saw what he meant a moment later, when the fire hit my stomach.
It was awful, like something that goblins would pass up. "Briggers, fiery nips," I swore. "How in 7 hells did Ferent make a living off of this?"
"Aye," Goodis nodded philosophically, "it does defy an easy comparison."
He poured another.
"To your new lad," he said, and added a folk blessing.
I had no choice. I had to join him.
What the liquor lacked in flavor, it made up for in potency. In a few scant moments I felt my whole body relax into a warm lethargy, as the fire seemed to suck both the cold and the energy from me.
"So, Mage Lord, Minolin," Goodis said, boldly switching to a more familiar tone.
He was entitled. For 6 months we'd been neighbors, just 2 good men working their trades. Our mutual change in station hadn't quite sunk in, or really affected our interpersonal relationship.
"How does it feel to be a dad for the first time? Nothing like it, is there?"
I exhaled sharply.
"No, nothing at all.
Even leaving aside the magical shenanigans, it's been a potent experience.
You look down on that helpless little face and..."
"Don't worry," he grunted in a fatherly tone. "That old bugger will be talking and sassing you before you know it. Messing up your work, getting into mischief, trying to drown themselves or their sisters in a well. Enjoy the peace and serenity now, and get some sleep while you can," he added wryly. "Can't say I slept proper since I was wed."
Goodis went on for almost an hour, dispensing invaluable advice about fathering I didn't know what to do with. I appreciated it, of course, but it was also a bit overwhelming. Luckily, his good wife came in from the kitchen shed, where she and her daughters had been plucking chickens, and interrupted his ramblings. I took the opportunity to excuse myself. I liked the snug little hold, but it was just a little too comfortable and warm on a day when I had miles to ride. As I was taking my leave, Gurris' wife asked if I could cast a mage light in her hall. While the stone underneath had been transformed, the carbon that comprised much of the dirt in the hall had not been, and now her home looked even dirtier than it had when she'd arrived, she was embarrassed to say. She wanted the light to be able to send her brace of drudges into the corners to attack the dirt. I chuckled and realized that I'd have the same problem at the castle. I was happy to help and cast four quick mage lights that would last for a day or so and sent them to line up along the ridgepole, providing illumination across the hall. That's when I noticed something interesting. I had used the same basic spell to cast all of the lights. In truth, with the witchstone, witch sphere, at my command, I could now do it as easily as coughing. I used the same measured amount of energy, the same series of symbols, and the same psychological components in each one. But they weren't uniform, I noticed. The ones on the east end, the solid white end of the hall, were bright and substantial. The one at the far end, firmly in the non-white western portion of the house nearest to the attached byre, was dimmer and less distinct. It was still plenty bright as 30 candles easily, but compared to the others, it wasn't nearly as distinct. "That's interesting," I mumbled while I studied the matter. Then I tried an experiment. Ordinarily, I would use a specialized magical instrument for this, but I didn't happen to have one. There are other ways to determine the magical resistance of a place, however. The mage lights had indicated a difference, perhaps. That was the only way I could explain the discrepancy between the lights. So I started at the west end of the hall, and walking slowly to the east, I cast a special mage light between my fingers. I barely gave it power, just enough for the surface to incandesce, producing a soft blue glow. Keeping the power level steady and constant, I watched as the globe between my fingers faded out completely by the time I got to the mundane end of the place. Gurris, his wife, and several members of the household had watched with interest as I worked. When I let the spell drop, they were all looking at me expectantly. I believe the stone affects magical resistance, I explained to the ignorant peasants. I began, struggling for a metaphor. Then I realized I had one at hand. Imagine the entire world is covered in 3 feet of snow, I began. Trying to get back and forth is hard. Not impossible, but hard, right? I saw several nodding faces. That snow resists you. It drags on your feet as you try to walk through it. Doing magic is normally like walking through 3 feet of snow, even for magi. If you're really good, you can learn how to make skis or snowshoes, or other magical stuff that can assist you getting through the snow. Magical snowshoes? One genius among the native Sevendori farmhands asked eagerly. No, the snowshoes are a metaphor, scolded a woman who might have been his wife or sister. Gods, you're an idiot. Go on, mage lord. Well, I said, a little taken aback. Ever since the blizzard, I said, since I didn't have a convenient name for the spell or event or whatever it was, everywhere you see this white stone, it is my belief that the magical resistance is lower. A lot lower, I added, as I glanced back at the four mage lights. How low? The woman asked, curious. Not that it would make any difference to her, but it was a very good question. I don't know yet, I confessed. I'm still studying the matter, but quite possibly very low, from what I'm seeing. Like there's hardly any metaphorical snow on the ground at all, thaumaturgically speaking. They all nodded sagely. I doubted if any of them understood the implications of that. I wasn't sure I did myself. Magic resistance is an important factor in most spells. Every place is a little more or a little less resistant to your consciousness imposing its will on the rest of the universe through the agency of magical force. There are all sorts of calculations for compensating for it, and there's even an established average constant that's often used when writing down spells in general. And as we learned, the sheer magnitude of the dead god's use of the Malapar under Beauvall Castle had somehow mitigated the natural, magical resistance of the Umbra, and by extension, the Penumbra. But for the most part, a mage is stuck with whatever the magical resistance happens to be at the place you're casting the spell. until now. Now, apparently, there was a way to lower the resistance. That's what the white stone seemed to do. And in all my thaumaturgical studies, I have never seen anything like it. Before I mounted Traveller, I made a point of prying a cobble out of the pile of rocks conveniently located outside of one of Southridge's many sheds, and much to my horse's dismay, I brought it with me. I headed straight west, out into the snow, which he didn't like much either. I headed slightly south toward the far end of Ketter's stream, in the direction of Matten's Helm. When I was halfway there, out in the middle of a wide-open pasture, I stopped Traveller, dismounted, and tried an experiment. I dropped the pure white stone to the snow-covered ground, and then began walking away. For the next hour, while my horse got increasingly impatient with me, I tried a number of experiments closer to and further away from the rock. Magic resistance in this part of the valley was more or less normal, until you got to the stone. I found that it started to fall off dramatically the closer I got to it. The field was normal, up to 50 feet away, but by 30 feet it had fallen to less than half of normal. While I was standing over it, it was as close to none as I'd ever seen. Just to be certain, I picked up the heavy rock and moved it a quarter mile and repeated the experiments. The field followed the rock, I saw, and left only the slightest residual lowering of resistance behind. Excited at the prospects, I magically split the rock. I found that both halves bore the special property, although it was apparently related to the mass of the stone. The halves only projected the field about half as far, although there was no diminishment of the strength of the effect. It was as if I had grown up in an arid valley and suddenly learned how to produce a portable rainstorm, or, more aptly, a snowstorm. I looked back across the vale toward the castle, situated on its plateau, rising high over the villages below. From here I could see the snow covering most of the countryside, the mountain behind it, and the castle itself, from the wall to the peak of my personal tower. To casual inspection, it looked as if the whole place was, indeed, still covered in snow. But the massive grey cliff behind the castle was now pure white, in some cases whiter than the snow around it. I could see other bare spots, nick points, where rock shone through the tree cover. From the castle outward, they were all white. If all of that white stone portended a very, very low magical resistance, then I considered, and then tried. At this range, even with my witch sphere, it should be pretty hard to control the green mage light that still glowed over the top of my tower. Yet when I reached out to it with my mind, it responded as if it was simply across the room. I played with it idly for a few moments, making it brighter, dimmer, flash, bounce, and cavort, until I realized I was doing the thaumaturgical equivalent of drumming my fingers, and stopped. I mounted Traveller and headed for Sagol's Hold next, and tried to understand just what the hell I had done. Before I arrived at the remote holding, I lost patience. I called on Penny's knowledge and wisdom. "Pentandra, I kind of did something," I began, once I had contacted her mind to mind. "I kind of enchanted my castle." "Your entire castle?" she answered, intrigued. "Tell me about it." "Well, slightly more than just my castle. Apparently, I enchanted a ring around my castle, too. About 7 square miles, actually."
7 square miles?
Min, what the hells were you doing?" "I was trying to encourage my son not to kill my wife," I said defensively. "There were some complications, arcane complications, and no, I don't know why. So I tried to help."
"Did it work?"
"I have a son," I pointed out, "and as a side effect, I have an enchanted castle, and an enchanted mountain or two, and a couple of villages, 2 yeomanries, a couple of fields, pastures, forests, and a goodly portion of my stream." I told her about that fateful night. I had purposefully been absent from my duties to oversee the war the last few weeks, citing the birth of my son as the reason, so this was the first even Penny had heard about it. When I got to the part about the stone's effects, she was floored.
That's impossible, Min," she insisted. "I've studied magic for years, and there's just no way to lower inherent magical resistance. Not in any meaningful way.
I know, I agreed, yet here it is. From what I can guess, it appears Sevendor Castle likely has the lowest magical resistance of any place on Kalador, and the effect seems to be portable. It's as if we got a magical snow that just will never melt.
That's amazing, Min. Do you realize what this could do for research?
I'm thinking of the practical elements, I said reasonably. But yes, I do realize what this could mean. I'm still studying it, and I want you to keep this confidential from our professional colleagues just now. But this could be a major development, Penny.
I know,
she agreed solemnly.
Can you send me some?
I'll pay for the messenger, double, if you can get it here in a week or two. I'll see what I can do. I want another Thaumaturge to take a look. But right now I could fart in Sevendor Castle and do more powerful magic than the ducal court wizard could do now, probably even without Irionite. I promised to send her a sample soon, close the connection, and then spurred Traveller on toward my brother-in-law's holding. My toes were achingly cold, and the liquor Guris had toasted me with had long worn off, and Traveller was not happy with our extended stay in the cold. Sagal's hold was far from the picture of efficiency Southridge had been, but then Sagal hadn't had a lot to work with and little time to do it in. Still, it was a far cry from the decrepitude I'd witnessed when I'd first rode into the holding. The stock and the yard were much more neatly organized. The windows on all of the outbuildings were repaired and properly shuttered, and much of the debris that had littered the area had been consolidated near the gate. Perhaps it was the snow covering everything that made it look better. Sagal himself was suffering from a cold he'd picked up at Yule, but the rest of his folk were faring well enough. They all hailed me warmly as I rode into the compound and escorted me to their new master's fireside, where he greeted me with a drink of some liquor far superior of that Ferrand had distilled. I accepted it gratefully, inquired as to his health, retold the story of the night of Menalion's birth again, and tried to explain the mysterious white stone that resulted. I skipped the thaumaturgical explanation this time.
Mayhap it was the snow, Sagal offered. I'm no mage, but snow seems almost magical itself. Perhaps it absorbed something from it, he suggested.
I didn't want to dispute his layman's assessment of a complex and sophisticated magical working. Sometimes ignorance is bliss.
Perhaps, I nodded. I've always enjoyed snow. I missed it when I was in Faris. I think I've made up for it after this blizzard. And snow is an intriguing thing, I admitted.
I always loved it,
he agreed, wiping his nose with a handkerchief.
Like little tiny stars, all crammed into one giant blanket, or something. I never was that poetical, he confessed.
I grunted a laugh.
Snow is pretty amazing. If you look at it with mage sight, I explained, you can see it at a more basic level, and then it really starts to get amazing.
Did you know that all snowflakes have six sides? They're all perfectly regular, and no two is alike, I pointed out. Sagal nodded, impressed with my learning.
Mayhap they're small, but if you put enough of them together, you can start a snowball fight. Or an avalanche, he said thoughtfully.
That was a big deal. Back in the jagged peaks of the Mindens, I'd seen them myself, thankfully from afar.
And it's all just water, slightly frozen, I said, shaking my head.
Tiny little specks of water. Who knew water could be so beautiful? To emphasize the point, I sketched the shape of a snowflake in the air, using magical light like a paintbrush.
That is pretty, Sagal nodded. I never knew they looked like that. Live and learn. He said, shaking his head in wonder.
Yes, it's not a well-known mystery outside of my trade. Almost no one really knows what a snowflake looks like. That caused something else to occur to me. You know, it's not the sort of thing that would be mistaken from afar for something else.
Maybe a spider's web, he suggested, or a wild star. I don't think I've ever recalled seeing a spider web on a shield.
Huh? I mean, begging the Mage Lord's pardon, he amended, wryly.
Oh, stuff the Lord stuff, we're family,
I griped. I was just debating what the new arms of Sevendor should be with Sir Kay not too long ago. It occurs to me that a snowflake is not likely to have been used as a charge.
Seems a little plain,
Sagal said critically, as he stared at the magical vision slowly rotating in front of his eyes.
What colour would the field be?
Green, I decided. Green and white. Seven Dory green and white. For official mage lord stuff. But I'd need a recognisable badge, too.
Why not reverse the colours?
Sagal suggested.
White snowflakes for the mage lord, green snowflakes for his servants.
I magically turned the snowflake in front of us green. We both liked it. So we toasted the snowflake of Seven Doors several times, until I realized that twilight was falling. I took my leave and headed back to the castle. Along the way, I sketched several designs for the flake in my mind, and tried them out. I suppose I left a trail of glowing, mage-lit, stylized snowflakes hanging in the winter twilight, all the way along the frozen stream bank, but looking back on them from the Seven Door Village Commons convinced me how pretty they were. The snowflake of Seven Door it was, then. Seven Door had a device now. The snow that never melted had not just altered my domain, it had also altered my heraldry.